It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. At least 9 Wisconsin communities have decided to stop adding fluoride to their public drinking water this year. They cite concerns about possible health risks that outweigh the widespread dental health benefits.
And at least 6 more communities, Buren, Black Earth, Ladysmith, Monroe, Peshtigo, and Wausau, are considering doing the same.
According to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Wisconsin overall shows a slow downward trend in public water system fluoridation since 2004, with that decline slightly accelerating in recent years.
A physician who focuses on public health joins us now to explain the latest health research on fluoride and its role in public drinking water systems.
Dr. Patrick Remington is an emeritus professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, explain to us, why is it the standard to put small amounts of fluoride in public drinking water? What benefits does it offer?
Well, we've known for 50 or more years that fluoride in drinking water reduces the incidence, how frequently kids get cavities, and it improves oral health. Back in the 1950s, more than half of persons over 65 were toothless. I remember growing up seeing ads for denture cream and Polident and ways to keep your dentures in your mouth and keep them clean. And you don't see those ads anymore because the percentage of people over 65 who don't have any teeth has plummeted. It's down in Wisconsin probably about 5% now. And so that really significant disability comes from cavities and fluoride. We know low levels of fluoride are extremely effective in reducing cavities in kids and improving oral health. So it's one of the 10 biggest public health success stories of the 20th century. And also it's a classic public health intervention in that you do one thing, put a little bit of fluoride in drinking water, and the entire population is protected.
Then why is fluoride becoming such a hot-button issue in some communities?
Well, we've always known that fluoride, like pretty much every other chemical, can be toxic at high doses. There's a saying that says that dose makes the poison. Drinking water at high doses can be a poison. You get a condition called hyponatremia. Anybody who drinks too much water can be poisoned and, in fact, can die. That happens often, infrequently in marathon runners, people exercising in warm climates. We know lead is a poison that even at very low doses can be neurotoxic. And so the same is true with fluoride. At high doses, it can be a poison. And that's why the recommendation for water fluoridation is quite low. And in fact, in the last decade or so, that level has dropped from 1.2 milligram per liter to 0.7 milligram per liter because people get fluoride in other ways. They get it in fluoridated toothpaste. And if you don't have supplemented drinking water, you can get it in fluoride rinses from your dentist. So because people get fluoride in other ways today, that level has been reduced.
And to put it into perspective, 0.7 milligrams per liter, it's about 3 drops of fluoride per 55 gallons of water. What is your sense in how closely WaterWorks in Wisconsin follow this recommendation from the CDC?
Oh, I, in preparation for this show, I checked the Madison fluoride levels. Our drinking water comes and it's right at about 0.7. That's if you get municipal water, you can probably go online and check the fluoride level, and I encourage people to do that. If you have a private well, there may be fluoride in the drinking water. There are some communities where the water that comes through the ground contains fluoride, and in those communities, supplementation would not be needed for people on private well water. But if you check your well water, and you find no fluoride, then I think you should have a conversation with your dentist about ways to get fluoride so that children, particularly young children, are protected and they can begin their life with good teeth, with teeth without cavities, and then have good oral health through their entire life.
You mentioned your dentist. If you have a dentist, if you get those regular checkups, if you get the fluoride rinses, can you talk about some of those barriers to that, you know, that dental access?
Well, again, that's one of the reasons that water fluoridation is considered a classic public health intervention, in that in public health, we try to make the healthy choice the easy choice or the default choice. But in fact, with water fluoridation, individuals don't have to choose at all. You just are protected by the fact that you're drinking water that is fluoridated. And so it's equitable. Everybody in the community is protected equally. So whether you have dental insurance or make a lot of money and can afford to see dentists quite often, or you may be poor. And we know that even though we provide health insurance for people who are poor, many dentists don't accept Medicaid as a payer. And so it's really challenging if you're poor to see a dentist, and leaving it up to individuals to find a dentist who is willing to have that conversation to provide the right amount of fluoride can be challenging for people who are struggling with poverty.
We're talking with Dr. Patrick Remington, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the debates about fluoride in drinking water in Wisconsin communities and looking at the public health perspective on this issue. Turning to Wausau here, one of the Wisconsin communities considering removing fluoride from their public drinking water system. Let's take a listen to a comment from a concerned citizen at last month's Wausau Waterworks Commission meeting.
We've had a lot of toxic chemicals in the past. We've had asbestos, tobacco, DDT, glyphosate, mercury, lead, J&J, talcum powders, lots of them. There's been personal injury attorneys lined up around the block, and they're still doing it. I still get solicitations for asbestos, things like that. We don't want to go through all that again.
We don't want to go through that all again. Some people worried about the effects of fluoride might equate it with substances that were once considered safe and then were found to be harmful. Should fluoride be in that category?
Well, I don't think it should be. No, I mean, the chemicals that that individual mentioned, asbestos, lead, cigarette smoke, we've known for a very long time that these chemicals are harmful. They have benefits in industry. Asbestos reduced the risk of fire. Lead made our car engines run better, knock less. And cigarette smoke provides people with nicotine. But those substances are harmful at any level, and they really don't provide a health benefit. So fluoride is a chemical that at low doses provides a significant health benefit. That is not debated. We have not seen progress in reducing toothlessness like we have without fluoride. So I think you need to begin by saying that fluoride has definite public health benefits in oral hygiene. Now, like any other chemical, it can be harmful. There are risks at high doses. Fluorosis is a condition that develops in teeth that can lead to staining if people aren't getting too much fluoride. And obviously, it becomes a poison at much higher levels. There is concern about neurotoxic effects of fluoride. In a National Toxicology Program report came out and said we ought to be concerned about that. And I think that's more than reasonable. We ought to be concerned about health effects. And research right now shows that at the low levels that are seen in water supplementation, there's no evidence, no firm evidence of any neurotoxicologic effects. So I think there's known benefit, and the evidence on risks at low levels is not there. So I think it's different than the chemicals the individual talked about.
And Dr. Remington, there have been concerns about infants drinking formula mixed with tap water if most of their diet at that age includes fluoridated water. Should the parent, the caregiver, avoid using tap water for that purpose?
No, in fact, fluoride is beneficial when teeth begin to be formed in utero and as young children. So I think by being in drinking water, it comes into the teeth through your body. You can apply it superficially on the outside with toothpaste and with rinses, but the benefit really comes from the fluoride protecting the enamel of the tooth when it's consumed. And again, we rely on our environmental specialists in communities to make sure that water level is within the recommended range. And it's a very low level. And at that level, there's no evidence of harm and significant evidence of benefit.
In our final moments together, turning to the political environment with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., President-elect Trump's nominee to lead the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and Kennedy saying last month that if he gets that position, he would advise all water systems to remove fluoride from public water. What kind of power could that move have over local water systems?
Well, I think we don't get our advice from single individuals. We get it from the consensus. Windsor is a community in Canada that in 2013 removed fluoride from their water supply. But 5 years later, they noticed the incidence of dental decay increased in kids. Mm-hmm. And the cost that they were paying for that increased dental decay far exceeded the cost of fluoridation. So they voted to put it back in. That's a great natural experiment of the cost and benefit. Again, we like lead, fluoride can be toxic at high levels, but unlike lead, fluoride has significant health benefits. And we need to have that conversation, talk about the risks and benefits, the cost effectiveness. But I think at the end of the day, I'm certainly glad we have fluoride in our community. And I would argue that we can continue it.
Dr. Remington, thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Patrick Remington, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health.
Coming up, Milwaukee's most impoverished neighborhoods are prone to dangerous electrical fires.
The wiring has been overused for over 50 years. We'll open up a box and some of the wires will just start crumbling in your hands.
But the nonprofit Ezekiel Hope is working on solutions. Find out more coming up on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In Milwaukee, suspected electrical fires disproportionately affect low-income Black renters.
A 2021 investigation by the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel found that the city's most impoverished zip code has electrical fires at 5 times the rate of the rest of the city.
Now, a Milwaukee nonprofit organization has stepped in to try to solve this problem.
Ezekiel Hope is repairing electrical code violations in dozens of homes with dangerous faulty electrical wiring in the city, and they hope to secure more grants to continue that work.
Master electrician Jim Gaylard is vice president and electrical trainer at Ezekiel Hope. That's an organization training people in the skilled trades and giving opportunities to minority contractors. Jim, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you guys for having me.
Can you acquaint us with Ezekiel Hope and the mission of your work?
Okay, Ezekiel Hope is a program where we try to engage more minority contractors. We try to engage people of the communities that we work in. I use abandoned foreclosed properties as a classroom, getting people underserved that haven't had the opportunity to be in the trades to give them a chance to see what it looks like, feels like, and learn how to get into the electrical trades. And once we rehab the house, we not only got a brand new furbished house, and we try to sell it to a first-time home buyer to help them create generational wealth.
So your apprentices are not just walking in your shoes, but they're seeing homes that are very much at risk for a fire. What are you seeing?
Well, we see a lot of things that I didn't think of when I became an electrician. Number one, there are not enough electricians, black and brown, or not enough electricians in these underserved communities. So I see a lot of handyman work where someone says they know a little bit about electrical work. So we see a lot of things. Over the years, we got some of the oldest housing stock in the United States that when they built these houses in the 1890s, 1930s, and 1950s even, they didn't count on microwaves, air fryers, electric dryers, electric stoves, or any of that type thing, air conditioners. So the wiring has been overused for over 50 years. We'll open up a box and some of the wires will just start crumbling in your hands. We've ran into knob and tube wiring. We've run into wiring that has gas lines running to it from the old gas lights. So it's a lot. It's a lot to take in, especially for someone who's learning a trade. They never would have thought that there was so much involved with it. But I love it.
I think the analogy that struck me that you used before, putting a Band-Aid on a broken leg, is the work that you're seeing that inferior on the electrical wiring?
It is. So there's a lot that we see that the people take for granted. Oh, the light works. You just can't use that switch up at the top of the stairs. You got to turn it on or off from down here. No, it's not wired right. Or an outlet. Well, we don't use that plug or that outlet or that switch because if you turn it on, then something blows downstairs and we have to go reset it. Well, there's a problem that needs to be addressed. So, yeah, we see a lot of things that are not good at all, and it puts people in harm's way.
What strikes me about your work is that you're not just making homes safer and livable, but you're also changing people's lives at the same time as you teach and share this work on the road to being an electrician. Can you talk about the changes you've seen in the people you've been mentoring?
Thank you for bringing that up, because that is really a passion of mine. It was hard for me to become an electrician, but I was really determined, and I wouldn't change it for anything in the world, because all of the hoops that I had to jump through and all of the barriers that were placed in front of me made me better at what I do, and it made me be able to tell other people what to look out for and how to set their game and their professionalism at such a high level that no one can bring them down from it. I told Mayor Barrett a few years back a list of people that I had at that time, and I think this was like 2012 to 14, somewhere around there. And on the list of about 84 of my trainees at that time, now it's over 400 or 500, but that list of 80 people, at least 75 of them were ex-felons. And they were all staying out of jail. They were all doing positive things. One of them actually started with me from the House of Correction, worked with me, helped me run the company. Now we fast forward 4 years, only 4 years later, he's working at a major corporation, making over $40 an hour, bought one of the houses that we rehabbed. And since that time, he's got his family in there, got it back together, stayed out of trouble. And he's bought another house since then and doing grill on the way to getting his master's license. And the only thing that they say, what's in it for you, Jim? The big thing in it for me is they reach down and help somebody who needs a little bit of help themselves.
That is such an incredible story. And the work is so life-changing. I wonder, you know, you and the people you're mentoring and training, you're seeing these very complex electrical problems. You're seeing code violations that you might not see in other neighborhoods. These are complex issues in these older homes. Does that mean that they are harder to fix and fix for good?
A lot of them are, because, again, the people that are living in a lot of these houses that we worked in these underserved areas, they've been adding things into their house, the new innovations, but they have not had the money to upgrade the wiring. And again, the wiring has been overused for over 50 years. It's not just been used, it's been overused that long. And it's only a matter of time, most of the time, before it breaks down from, you know, the stress and the strain. It wasn't built for that. But no one really had that type of, not many of the people in these areas have that type of money. So, again, they put a Band-Aid on a broken leg. And it's a blessing sometimes how things work out. We may run into a knob and tube, which is the antique wiring when they first came out past the gas light. And then we might get two or three of them in a row. Repetition is always the best teacher. So the more I can expose them to, the better prepared they are to run into anything. And the last thing I want to mention about the thing that I interact with my crew about when I'm training them is, if you got a nice fat check coming on Friday, just may not act a fool on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. He's got something to go for. You know, yeah. I want to give them a lofty goal that they can see themselves attaining. And knowing that they're a hero coming into these people's houses where we've averted fires, but it's great that we're able to do this. I love it.
Jim, we can hear your passion, and I just want to look into the future for a final question, because Ezekiel Hope has received some grant funding. How do you see Ezekiel Hope growing and evolving and being able to scale up this work?
The future, I hope we can get a warehouse type situation where I can train more people, because what we're also finding out in these communities big time is these people don't have access to black and brown electricians or electricians in their community. And I want to be a big part of changing that. I would love to get a real training center where I can simulate almost every situation. I've been in this trade for about 40 years, mm-hmm. and I've seen a lot. I love to see us in a training center cranking out 50 to 100 skilled, highly skilled technicians every year. That's where I hope to see us go in the future.
Oh, Jim, thank you so much for sharing this vision. Thank you for your work. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate getting this out.
Jim Gaylard is a master electrician and vice president of Ezekiel Hope. That's a Milwaukee nonprofit that supports low-income renters and homeowners and trains people in the skilled trades. We're talking about the risk of electrical fires in Milwaukee's poorest neighborhoods, which disproportionately affects low-income black renters. Our next guest has investigated this issue over the years. John Dietrich is an investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. John, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Can you give us a sense of the scale of this problem? And I know this stems back to an investigation in 2021 where you were able to go into some homes and really see the electrical wiring alongside an electrician.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So we focus specifically on the zip code 53206, which is the zip code that is most impoverished in Milwaukee and predominantly a black neighborhood. And we focused in on renters because in that particular neighborhood and in this parts of the city, renters are really beholden to landlords to be able to have their issues fixed. And what we found is that there were electrical fires that were happening at a much higher rate in those neighborhoods. Now, the data is problematic. And that's one of the findings of our investigation is that there's not complete fire data and even fatal fire data. And this isn't just a problem in Milwaukee. This is a nationwide problem. The accuracy of fire data is lacking. But we found over this period of time, we identified about a dozen fires in this 3-year period that had this cause. But our indications are that there's more fires than that. Some of these were fatal. We also found that one of the fires that we found that were fatal that killed Clarence Morrell and Patricia Colston was not even in the data. And we featured that fire. So the data itself is not telling us exactly what the issue is. But the other thing we did is we wanted to go into the homes and say, how big of a risk is it? And that's where we hired a master electrician to come in. And we did a scientifically supported sample within the zip code and found that a vast majority of the homes we could extrapolate had unsafe wiring in them.
The scale of this problem, 3.5 years later, Has anything changed? Have you been able to follow up with some of these homes?
Well, yes. What happened after, shortly after our reporting, there were landlords who stepped forward and said they wanted to make some changes, you know, perhaps out of from the publicity or whatnot. But these are expensive fixes, though. And so, you know, some of the solutions to this were they fall on to the landlords. And, you know, if landlords are really interested in bottom lines and they can rent places that are unsafe, you know, there isn't a big incentive. The incentive to do this would be the city of Milwaukee coming in and doing proactive investigation, proactive inspection. That is not allowed under state law. There's very tight restrictions that have been enacted by the state legislature on cities like Milwaukee from doing proactive inspections. They can do reactive inspections. The city of Milwaukee is still trying to find ways these years later to do that, and they've so far been stymied in that way.
And what struck me is landlords and management companies, some of them responded to you by saying, okay, yes, there is a major electrical problem, but we can't do anything until the tenant vacates, which really puts all the onus on the renter to act, to move so that the next renter can perhaps be safer and the landlord in good faith can do the fixes. What is problematic about that?
Well, it's hugely problematic because there's sort of a you know, an assumption that you have to move to have a life safety issue, you know, fixed. And, you know, talking to electricians, this is not something where you have to move out. What that usually indicated was you know, a landlord or a property management company that really wanted to flip the house. Mm. They wanted to do more than just the electrical, and they wanted to increase the rent. And so they wanted to increase the rent a lot. And so getting the tenant out of there and getting a new tenant who doesn't know what the old rent is one of those strategies. But it's not required. You don't have to move out of your house. If you or I had major electrical work, you don't have to move out of the house for that. But that was something that we heard from you know, from some of the companies. I mean, the other thing that people were faced with, and we heard this repeatedly from tenants, is that they were saying, well, you know, we know that electrical, you know, is probably unsafe. I mean, historically, we talked to people who live in 53206 who have lived there for years and years, and they just know, like, you know, you can't leave things plugged in your house, for instance, when you leave your house.
Or if it rains, you know, you don't turn on certain light switches or something.
Exactly. Like, or children have been sort of, yes, they've been told from their parents, don't turn that on because the water trickles in. And exactly that outlet is unsafe, you know, in rain. And, but the calculation, the terrible calculation that some of these tenants have to make is that they're saying, I will take the risk with bad electrical because this place is relatively clean. There's no rodents, there's no rats or other pests in here. You know, that sort of thing. The walls have been painted in the last, you know, 5 or 10 years, you know, or something like that, you know, but we'll take that chance because it's relatively, and that's just a terrible calculation that no tenants should have to make.
So when your investigation came out, Governor Evers called the findings gut-wrenching. Now there's an organization, Ezekiel Hope, which is really trying to do some of the free electrical work for these homes that are in jeopardy. Is there any type of motion at the state or local level to address this issue?
There really hasn't. Right now, the effort and Jim's effort on the ground to make these changes, you know, are really grassroots. We learned about Jim's work through the course of reporting this project. And when we leaned into some of the grassroots efforts that not only would help improve the condition of housing, but also help train people in the community to become electricians. Well, it's encouraging on a number of levels, but they're funded primarily through private sources. And to date, this has not been funded through government sources. And, you know, and I do recall that quote from Governor Evers, and we've not seen a big effort by the state to the bottom line is funding this. Mm. It's costly, and to figure out who can pay for this work.
One thing I learned from your reporting is that just because you live in a century-old house or something older doesn't mean that your dwelling is a major fire risk. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So what we did, I appreciate that point. What we did is we looked at electrical fires in different areas where the housing the age of the housing stock was similar. And what we found in higher demographic areas on Milwaukee's east side and a part of the Shorewood neighborhood in the suburb, they do not have the electrical fires nearly at the rate, even though the age of the housing is similar, even older in some cases than the neighborhoods in 53206 that we looked at.
John, one final note. From your reporter's eyes, you've investigated this issue for years. What are you watching for next in this particular zip code and elsewhere on faulty wiring and electrical code violations?
There is still a lack of solid data that to actually come down to the cause, because that's what we found a lot of times is that the fire investigators would not definitively call an electrical fire. And so a lot of the, when we look through the paperwork, we could find these. So we continue to watch fires and say, are there some that are not being accurately classified as that? I mean, the other thing too, is that following up on Jim's efforts, and I'm following up with folks in City Hall and in Madison to say, you know, asking the question afresh, say, is there an effort to come up alongside what Jim's doing and his, you know, in the entities are supporting him. And particularly, is there an effort to help vulnerable renters who we found are in these dangerous situations?
John, thank you for your work. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Kate. Thank you.
John Dietrich is an investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel who's been reporting on dangerous electrical wiring in Milwaukee's poorest neighborhoods. And earlier, we heard from Milwaukee Master Electrician Jim Gaylard about training future electricians and his organization, Ezekiel Hope, that is repairing electrical wiring for free in underserved neighborhoods.
Coming up, check out new urban forestry projects bringing trees to 13 communities around the state.
Whether it's trees in our backyards or trees in our city parks or trees that align our streets, they provide so many benefits to our communities here in Wisconsin.
That's coming up next here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. According to the American Lung Association, nearly 4 in 10 Americans live in places with unhealthy levels of air pollution.
Wisconsin is tackling this problem with trees. The State Department of Natural Resources is awarding federal funds to plant and maintain trees to improve air quality and to provide other benefits. Nearly $4 million from the Inflation Reduction Act is going to 13 communities in the state.
Jay Dampier is the grant coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR. Tim Bull is the city forester of Sheboygan, one of the communities receiving support. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And Jay, thanks for being with us.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
All right, now people hear the words trees and forests, and they think of a walk out in the woods. Well, now hold on. We've got trees in our cities. Can you talk about the value of trees and urban forestry for the people who live in these communities?
Trees are incredibly important to our urban living spaces. They provide shade. They provide carbon sequestering for reducing carbon dioxide, which leads to climate change. Aesthetically, trees provide just beautiful spaces for us to experience a bit of respite during our busy days and hectic lives. We can get into parks, whether it's trees in our backyards or trees in our city parks or trees that align our streets. They provide so many benefits to our communities here in Wisconsin.
And Tim, what do you see as the value of the trees that you work on and plant and take care of for the people of Sheboygan?
Yeah, street trees, are number one trees that I'm working on. And the one thing that maybe you might not think about is the storm. When we get a big storm, a bunch of water coming down and the streets might flood, But those trees are really helping reduce that storm water, and it would be much worse without them. So that's one thing you might not think about. But Jay mentioned all the other great things, or a lot of the other great things about trees. Property values, the shade, the reducing the energy consumption of your house or your building, those would be the big ones.
And Tim, we've got this money coming through the DNR from the Inflation Reduction Act, this federal money. What is that going to help you all do in Sheboygan with your urban forestry?
The Inflation Reduction Act, this opportunity through the DNR was really, really something neat. And it identified areas of the city that were considered disadvantaged based on some environmental factors. And the biggest one, the one we targeted for this grant, was the air quality. So roughly half of the city fell above the threshold, which put it into the qualifying area because of the air quality, the ground level ozone being the primary pollutant I'm talking about. So the grant is going to allow us to plant more trees. We're going to plant a total of 660 trees. We are not only going to plant more trees, we're actually going to try to keep some of the mature trees that we already have. So specifically, I'm talking about ash trees. Emerald ash borer has been an insect that was found here in 2016, and it's been devastating. We lost probably about 3,000 of our street trees. So we have about 2,000 left that we've been treating with an insecticide to keep them alive. And this grant is going to give us additional funding to continue those insecticide treatments.
And Jay, as you at the DNR were evaluating, you know, where this federal money is going to go, what were your priorities for the kind of neighborhoods that might most benefit from support with their trees?
Yes. Yeah, so this funding was allocated to, and Tim used the term, I believe, disadvantaged communities. And so we had particular areas within the state of Wisconsin that qualified. Not every area qualified. And these were communities that were experiencing or are experiencing higher economic, social, and environmental burdens relative to the rest of the state. So in the case of Sheboygan, they made the compelling argument for the ground level ozone. Other communities might have been economic hardship in particular areas. There are cases where, so largely economic and environmental were the big ones that stood out. Also, with this particular, the IRA, Inflation Reduction Act funding, the proposals that ranked higher tended to also engage the community in various ways. So there was a real community engagement component. Those ones tended to score a lot higher. So municipalities, as in the case of Sheboygan, were awarded. And we also had grantees that were from some of our tribes, as well as nonprofits throughout the state. So it wasn't just municipalities.
And Jay, you picked up on something I wanted to bring up, community engagement. I've read case studies in communities around the U.S. where, hey, yeah, we're going to put trees in low-income neighborhoods, yay. But they didn't actually talk to the people who lived in those low-income neighborhoods. The project kind of went sideways. What does community engagement look like? What kind of connection and outreach do you want to see to communities as we develop these kind of projects?
Yeah, it's absolutely key. So in each project was obviously different in how they approach that. In some cases, the awarding the proposals that were scored higher engaged community members early on. So there is one project in Eau Claire where there's a neighborhood group that was you could tell that through the proposal that they were highly engaged with the city during the grant writing process, the proposal writing process, and they felt that this was critical for their neighborhood. And they engaged with the city in the grant writing and how it was going to look. In Eau Claire, I believe there was risk trees that were taken down. So again, they're being affected by the emerald ash borer as well. So they were removing trees, and then they're also regreening trees, basically planting trees as well. Another project had a similar sort of approach is in Racine, where again, a lot of the work was a standard urban forestry, urban greening type project. But there was also a key component where they were engaging lower income communities that were also Spanish speakers. So their part of their project is engaging the community with education on the urban forest, and folks in those communities can apply for a tree to plant in their own yard. And then they would have the training and the education provided in a language that they can understand, which in that case would be Spanish.
And Tim, what does that kind of community outreach look like in your community? How do you, as a city forester and other city staff, work with neighborhoods and people when you're working on these tree plans?
Yeah, great question. So we are planning, we've met with, I think, three or four already, neighborhood associations, so that the city has a number of them throughout. And my goal is to meet with every neighborhood association that's within the qualifying area or adjacent to it, and then, you know, inform them what's going on. And when we're planting new trees, whether it's part of this grant or not, we started a new system where we send them a postcard in the mail where they'll find out, hey, a new tree is coming. And then there's a link or in a QR code that they can follow to get to our website, our Department of Public Works website, where we have a new tree watering pledge, we call it. So if they're willing to take on the responsibility of watering the newly planted street tree near their home, they can sign up on our website. And then the map will show, you know, that one's being watered. So our own city staff here can skip watering that one and focus more on the ones that aren't being watered by others. So it's an opportunity to get them engaged. And I know I can see on the map there is probably at least a dozen people that already have signed up, but we're hoping for much more starting next spring when we plant more trees.
We're talking about state and local efforts to improve urban forestry in Wisconsin using some money from the Inflation Reduction Act. We have Jay Dampier with us, grant coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR, Tim Bull, city forester in Sheboygan. Jay, can you take us on a tour? We've mentioned a few of the different projects around the state. What are some of the different things that we haven't talked about? I understand Stevens Point, fruit trees, for example, are a big part of the plan.
That's right. Yeah, Stevens Point, what ranked them really high was certainly the urban forest, or sorry, the food forest, was another component that proposal writers could target. But what was neat about the Stevens Point proposal was they didn't just target these disadvantaged communities. They prioritized within. So there were some housing areas and some areas that they said, sure, we have this general polygon on the map, on the GIS map, that's obviously identified, but we're going to target areas that are even within there. So that's really made that proposal really strong. Other awards that we haven't discussed yet today is a couple nonprofits. So we were able to award three nonprofits. And again, there's a real neat community engagement component with these ones. So for example, Operation Fresh Start, based out of Madison, they do a lot of work engaging community members in job skills and workforce development. So their proposal is targeting not only people who could benefit from employment within urban forestry and arboriculture training, but also the work would benefit those communities. And those folks are drawn from the disadvantaged communities. So at the end of the trainings and the workforce development that Operation Fresh Start's engaging in, folks would walk away with a bunch of certifications. I believe it's chainsaw safety, first aid, some key industry certifications that would help those folks get good jobs afterwards. Also, other community engagement. There's another entity in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Water Commons, and they had a huge community engagement component too, where they're, again, removing some of the risk trees with you know, right off of private properties. They're developing a tree board, so where the community can truly get engaged and make a decision and engage on how their urban forest we managed within their particular communities that they're targeting there. Up north, Rhinelander and also Bad River Band, not too far from Ashland. Bad River is planting some food forest type planting as well. And the really neat thing about Bad River is that they're planning to plant culturally appropriate trees and shrubs that can be used for medicine trees and food trees. So, and in the case of Bad River, they're going to be planting some silver maple because culturally that's an important species for that community.
Tim, I want to dig deeper into one of the key points you made about Sheboygan, that the trees, one of the goals is to boost air quality. Now, I get, you know, on a global scale, we need trees to produce oxygen that we breathe. But really, at a local scale like that, if you've got, say, a surface level ozone pollution problem, getting more trees up can really put a dent in something like that?
Well, I think it can. The thing is, what I think about is I was hired here in 2016, the same year that emerald ash borer was found in the city. And at that time, we had about 20,000 street trees. Now, since then, fast forward till now, 8 years later, we're probably sitting around 16,000 street trees. So we lost a lot of ash and we lost some other trees just because of various reasons. So our canopy or our opportunity for more trees is pretty vast. And the trees, they can filter out these nitrogen oxides and VOCs, these harmful pollutants. They can filter them out and really reduce that ground level ozone. Is it, you know, if you plant one tree, it's not going to make much difference. But if we're talking 6,000 or more trees,
sure,
and these things get mature, if they have the opportunity to get mature, which is another really important thing, planting the right tree in the right spot, that's something I'm really pushing. What we're trying to inform everyone about is when we plant a new street tree, we're putting the right tree in the right spot, meaning we're looking at the utilities, we're looking at how much space there is. We're seeing if there's a, you know, if there's a street light, if there's a driveway really close, it'll allow them to reach maturity age before they, you know, become a problem for something else.
Jay, another big picture thing I wanted to bring up is, you know, with global warming, we hear concerns about urban heat islands. Where if it's all, you know, concrete and asphalt, it's absorbing that heat and it's a double whammy without the trees. Then people don't have shade to get relief from that heat that is being absorbed and then radiated back out in the city. How much can tree planting in urban areas help with something like that?
Yeah, certainly localized. I couldn't throw the numbers at you today, but in a localized sense, for sure. You just imagine, you know, walking in a hot parking lot, you know, and it's 85 degrees outside, and then you just scooch over, you know, maybe, you know, a few hundred yards and you're in a park, you can feel the difference. And so certainly urban heat islands is a major issue in our areas where that are highly built up. And trees can certainly contribute, certainly on a localized factor for sure, reduce that heat, which again, as I believe Tim hinted at earlier too, that also reduces our energy costs. So if you have shading, over parking lots or near homes, that also, or buildings, that also shades the heating, that's that solar gain that comes in through the windows and through the walls and heats up the buildings. And that can also cut down on energy costs, which in some cases on our grid, some of the energy does come from fossil fuels. And so you also consider it as far as, you know, you're not burning coal or burning other carbon-based sources for our electricity generation.
Tim, I wanted to ask you about the timeline here. And obviously it's December, not a great time to put trees in the ground. And you mentioned there's some serious thought and planning going into this. What would be the timeline then for these trees to start going into the ground?
Yeah, so this is a three-year grant, and we're going to take all 3 years of it. We're going to do a total of 660 tree plantings, which we're going to spread out over 3 years. So we're going to plant the first 220 next year, and it won't be until the fall. We kind of have a holding area, a gravel bed, that we'll get the trees delivered in the spring. We'll put them in that holding area. The roots will be able to grow, really expand, probably almost double in size in some cases. And then in the fall, we'll plant those trees along the street. And we'll do that. So basically fall of 2025, 220 trees. We'll do the same thing in 2026. And then in 2027, because the grant ends, we'll plant those last trees in the spring.
We'll leave it there. Tim, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And Jay, thanks for being with us.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you.
Jay Dampier is Inflation Reduction Act Grant Coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR, specializing in urban forestry funding. And Tim Bull is the City Forester of Sheboygan.
We just heard about tree planting efforts in Wisconsin communities in order to boost air quality, provide shade, and deal with the impacts of climate change.
And we want the tree report from your community, whether you're in a city, a rural part of the state, or all points in between. Are there enough trees where you are? Do you wish there was more shade in your local downtown or park or neighborhood or your own yard?
And has there been an effort to plant more trees in your community? Have you been planting more on your own property? How is that going?
Tell us all about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or tree mail, I guess, wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or call 888-642-0232 and leave us a voicemail.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.